Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And to start with, as we promised you at the end of last week's program, a surprise. The surprise is a revelation that if you want to see a mass of really happy people, you should go into the Dominic Ansel Bakery in London, where people jam in and they're up to their ears in sweets, exactly what the English love.
But with some twists, some interesting things that they're doing that they're not doing in
New York City.
They're doing savory items. They're doing some English-inspired items. They're even doing, for the season of the year when we were there, which is just before Christmas,
mince pies.
Mince pies with
reindeer heads.
with reindeer antlers and a Rudolph red nose.
Yeah.
Nothing if not creative. And the amazing part about this is such an incredibly accessible location because it's right around the corner from the Victoria bus station. And just a little bit further from the Victoria Railway Station, both places that you might be frequenting when you're in London.
It's big.
It's a big place with lots and lots of people, as Anne said, with very, very happy faces. And here are the two people principally responsible for that, the assistant manager and the chef.
I'm really embarrassed to admit this, but I've just taken a bite, a very first bite of a cronut. And actually, what we're doing is we're sampling the new Dominic Ansel Bakery in London. And we're going to be talking to Rachel Wicking and to Ryan Thompson, who are Rachel's the spokesperson, manager, and Ryan is the chef here. And I'm embarrassed to tell you what all we've eaten. We have all these plates in front of us. And the servings are, they're just so much bigger than I ever even envisioned them. Let me say that you already know, Rachel and Ryan, that I've never had a cronut before because I wouldn't wait in line for 2 hours to get one. I don't wait in line 2 hours to get anything to eat. I didn't have to do that now, and now I am a sophisticated cronutian. Let's ask Rachel a little bit about the background of how this place ended up and how Dominique chose London.
Either one.
Okay. So I think for Dominique, he has been in New York for some time now, and London... and his following has been all over the world, but London seemed like a very good next step for him. The sort of community here and all the different influences in all of the food in the markets here, all fed very well into sort of items that he could then create. So the menu here specifically is tailored to London and that sort of crowd that we have that come in. So we've got inspiration from the Middle East, we've got inspiration from Spain, we've got inspiration from London, we've got inspiration from all over the UK, and I think that really fed his creativity, so coming to London seemed like a good next step.
Now, Ryan, you were a pastry chef before, but you still had to learn a whole new skill set with the kind of pastries that Dominique sells here. And his bakery. What was the most dramatic learning curve you had?
Well, for me, the biggest learning curve was to when I went over to New York to see the pace that Dominique's bakeries run at. Now, it's something in his bakeries that they're busy, as everybody knows, all through the day, from opening to closing. And I think the standard in the UK is that you do get busy maybe for afternoon tea, or you might get busy for a lunch service. Whereas Dominique's bakeries are busy from the moment you open to the moment you close. And it's trying to meet that demand and keep to motivate a team to keep going and to produce throughout the day, throughout the night, to make sure that we have all of our menu options available at all times. But at the same time, we keep all our guests happy and keep our quality to exactly how Dominique would like it.
Let's just try and pick a couple of numbers here. How many chefs are in the back? And how many people on average do you think are in the front? Today you can hear, listeners, there are a whole lot of people in the front. But those numbers interest me.
We currently have 21 pastry chefs on site, and we have a further three more chefs downstairs who look after our savory menu, because we do have a large restaurant on the side which does savory food as well. In terms of footfall on a guest perspective, I would say probably
between 1,000. Yeah, 700 to 1,000.
Yeah, 700 to 1,000 people queuing for cake all throughout the day. And the good thing as well with Dominique's Bakery here is people queue to sit down to eat, but they also queue again to then take away to family, relatives. We're right next to the local coach station, so a lot of people travel across the country with our products to take them back to Europe as well. So it is something that it's a huge, vast number. So we have a lot of chefs working at a lot of time of the day. So,
well, you know, I mean, his signature that really put him on the map was the cronut. How much do Britons, Londoners, love the cronut? Is it the same as in New York?
In London, the cronut is, we are very different in the way that we approach a bakery compared to New York. In New York, they will queue until it's sold out. We've found here in London, it's not quite the same. We do still sell out every day. So the volume of the queue is not quite the same. In the morning, people are rushing past to go to places. We find that we get our busy period is normally about 10:30, 11 o'clock. The interest in the cronut was huge and still is huge. Every time we release a new flavor like we just have for January today, the interest is massive. But it's just introducing this pastry to London as well, because there's been a lot of people in London that have tried to copy it. So I think that it's introducing them to the real product itself, the genuine version. And I think that's what so many people have been surprised about, the sugar levels, the textures, the quality of the product inside is far beyond anything that was in London before.
Now, Rachel, I mean, you're in contact with the public all day long. And also, Dominique created special pastries for London. Could you tell us what some of those are?
So our Welsh rarebit croissant is one of our London exclusives that you just enjoyed. It is a croissant base with a stout and Worcestershire sauce and cheddar bechamel inside. It's got mustard and cheese on top. It's very popular. It's sort of our take, or Dominique's take, on a very traditional breakfast item, Welsh rarebit, which a lot of English people will enjoy. And yeah, it's been very, very popular. We've also got several sweet items that are specific to London. Our banoffee paella, with beautiful caramelized bananas. It's very special the way that it's served. It comes from a paella pan, which is something, again, playing on the multiculturalism of London. Yes, we've got lots of fun things specific to London.
Now, over here is a highly seasonal item called a mince pie. Will you be doing other seasonal items too? I mean, there's, for example, Easter in our household growing up. There was a cake called a simnel cake, which had slices of marzipan down the center. And then the Christmas cakes with dried fruit and nuts in them. Will you be doing things like that that vary by the season?
Yes, we will be doing seasonal cakes. We do have our Christmas pudding on the shelf for our retail items for this year. It was something that I was very passionate about to introduce to Dominique himself, was mince pies and Christmas pudding. We are, again, sticking with Epiphany as well and doing a Galette d'Oie. As we come into Valentine's and Easter, it really gives our chefs a chance to express themselves. And it's one of the key things about being a chef is having the ability to express your true feelings through your cakes and your designs and everything like that. So, it's been a key part of Dominique's, inspiration towards myself as well, is that I can put some of my items onto the menu here in London. My team can create dishes that can go onto the menu. And it really does inspire chefs as they're growing into young managers or growing into stronger chefs, that they can progress, see their items on, and just the pride that they take when Dominique posts a picture of one of their dishes. It really does set a fire in them to keep going and to push on in their career.
Was there some reaction that you did not anticipate? I mean, I would think that England would be the prime place to have any kind of a sweet shop, any kind of a bakery, because of this universal sweet tooth. But did you find any pushback from the English on any of the products you thought were just going to go over like crazy? Any adjustments you had to make in your plan for the menu or the business?
To be honest, not so much. We've done a lot of product development before we opened that we had to go through. Dominique and the team in New York, that's why myself, I went over to New York prior to the opening, not only to train with them to learn their standards, but also to express my feelings about the menu to them. So there were dishes that we were designing, which I said I don't think will be suitable towards an English market, from my previous history in pastry here in London as well. So some things we put off this year, and we might try them next year when we're established and the audience know us better. We might bring those items in. We've adjusted sweetness levels as we've gone through. And the only other major adjustment I would say would be like the creams, and flour and gluten levels, because they're very different from Europe to America. So a lot of the recipes we've had to adjust as we've gone through, because the same recipe here will yield a completely different result to what it would in New York. So that's been a little game that we've had to play with each menu that we've done. But other than that, no, that's why we go through such vigorous, development stages. Quality checks to make sure that all of these things are kept to a level.
Well, is it true that the British have a much sweeter tooth than anybody else in the world?
I think so. I certainly think the sweets here sell very well. And, yeah, petit gâteau do very well here. I think pudding as a whole is something very popular in London. So we'll have people come in for tea in the afternoon and have cake, and we'll have people come in for savory, but of course they will get a slice of banoffee paella at the end, or they'll get some of our pastries and cakes at the end, or takeaway items as well. We do have a lot of people that come in, to get treats for after dinner, some of our larger cakes as well, they'll pop in to take away for desserts, for dinner parties and things. So, yeah, I think pudding and pastries are very, very big in London. And I think there was a need for this here.
Now, somebody mentioned earlier on, this location is very convenient to Victoria train station, I guess, the Victoria bus station, but it's much more than that, because Elizabeth Street, where you're located, is a rather iconic street when it comes to things retail. I mean, who are some of your neighbors here?
Well, we're very lucky to have Peggy Portion just up the road, which is a very beautiful cake shop. We've also got Donna Ida, and a lot of other beautiful shops up the road, and bespoke and high-end items. We've got the Thomas Cubitt Gastropub as well, so we've also got a lot of foodie places nearby. In general, the whole street is full of beautiful shops that also all get into the festive spirit. There's a Christmas competition that goes on based on their window display. So if you take a stroll up now, you'll see everything's lit up very beautifully as well.
Listeners, if you're in other parts of the world, and if you're in other parts of the United Kingdom, please don't be concerned. Dominique Ansel and Ryan and his friends will get around to you. We feel sure they will. In the meantime, You'll just have to be patient and pop up across the channel or across the big pond or wherever you need to go in order to lay your hands on a cronut or a banoffee pie or a Rudolph the Red-Nosed mince pie. And the last item you mentioned earlier on, you have savory items. We tried one of them. There are actually several, all of which sounded very interesting.
Yeah, so our savory menu is something that we did have to do a lot of development with, being all of us on site, our pastry chefs. So it was something we had to research in, to learn a lot about as well, flavors and connections of flavors. Where we mentioned earlier that we take things from different cultures, we actually have little kedgeree croquettes, which we have a quail egg, which is wrapped inside the spiced rice mixture with turmeric and all the bay leaves and cardamom, then, which is deep fried. But as you cut it open, the quail egg inside is just liquid and just oozes out as you open it, with a homemade mayonnaise and just a little sprig of lemon. So it's a snack item, but it's a beautiful thing. And then we also have Dominique's favorite, which is the croque monsieur, which we've adjusted to London. We have a pork alternative and we have a turkey alternative to fit in with our halal guests in this area as well. So it's little things like that we've made adjustments in the menu to make us available to as many guests as possible. We don't want to turn anybody away for any particular reason or anything like that. So where we can, we will bend over backwards to try and help our guests, to help them to experience our bakery.
Well, you sound like you're having a great time, both of you, Rachel and Ryan. Thank you for hosting us. And we didn't clean our plates, but we had a good time, too.
And we started off today's program far from home, across the big pond, as they say. We're going to continue with the rest of today's program really close to home, back in our home city of Pittsburgh, and we'll keep you guessing as to what we might be covering until after the break, when we'll be, because we'll be right back, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, yes. At first, national media seemed surprised that so much was happening in Pittsburgh with its dining and drink scene. Not so much anymore. I think they've finally caught on that it's a very exciting place to be. And today we bring you an outstanding restaurateur, chef restaurateur, who not only revitalized the dining scene in downtown Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, of course. But he has a whole plan of action for continuing to expand his restaurant concept and success. Let Rick DeShantz of Richard DeShantz Restaurant Group tell us about that. Rick DeShantz of Richard DeShantz Restaurant Group. You were such a successful restaurateur in Pittsburgh. It seems as though you popped out of no place all of a sudden, and we both know that that wasn't the case. You have certainly done your service and earned your points in this industry. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about how you started in the restaurant industry?
Well, my first restaurant downtown was 909, located on Penn Avenue in Pittsburgh, PA.
Before that.
I started way before that, of course. But that was my first single by myself restaurant that I opened. Before that, I opened up Cafe Richard. It was a cafe in a strip that was open for about 4 years before I sold it. I focused on homemade croissants and danishes and tarts and sandwiches and dry goods of that nature. And then I decided I wanted to do something else, and I started designing a more of a fine dining, a white tablecloth style restaurant, and that's where I came up with the concept 909. 909 was, I was part of 909 for about 4 years, and then I ended up selling 909, and I opened up Meat and Potatoes. Meat and Potatoes was probably my first, like, Academy Award, my first home run. 120-seat restaurant, probably do about 450 covers a night, just took off right from the beginning. You know, after coming from 909, doing this really fine white tablecloth dining atmosphere, I knew I wanted to something a little more for the people of Pittsburgh. I knew I wanted to do something that really catered to Pittsburgh itself, and that's how I came up with the name Meat Potatoes itself. I knew they would kind of understand that name, Meat Potatoes. I knew they would actually gravitate towards the name, and it was like just this very unpretentious, fun, loud, you know, watering hole type of establishment, almost like a chop house. And everything on that menu was, you know, really designed around the Pittsburgh clientele base. Heavy, big pork chops and steaks and tomahawks and bone marrow, and just a really fun place to have some bourbon, some whiskey, and really unwind. Really casual atmosphere coming from, like, white tablecloth. You know, I wanted to strip down the restaurant from all the things that cost a lot of money that made the check averages higher, from, like, the fine china to the silverware to the crystal glasses to the tablecloth. I got rid of that so I could really focus on just the food itself and really give, like, a quality product at a reasonable price. And like I said, go after the, you know, the Pittsburgh demographics, go after the Pittsburgh market. And it just took off, a really great response to it. And I think that was really the turning point in my career, the one that really pushed me over the mark. And what, like you said, I've been doing this a long time, but that was the point that, like, pushed me where I am today. And it really sprung me up where financially was I was able to open up more. After that, you know, we started thinking about doing something else as a chef, as an artist, as a creator. You always want to do more things. You always want to, you know, you don't want to read the same book over and over again. You want to do things. You want to learn about more cuisine. You want to push the envelope. There was a space open down the street. And, you know, as much as I love meat potatoes, as much as meat potatoes was such a powerhouse moneymaker, it was so busy, it was really hard to work with local farms, and it was really hard to, you know, do more attention to detail dishes. I mean, this kitchen was a turn-and-burn animal, and which is fun in its own right, but I wanted to slow the pace up a little bit, do a little more attention to detail, do a bigger bourbon list, and that's where I came up with the concept Butch and Arai. You know, work with more farm to table, a little more intricate plating going on, a little more intricate drinks going on. Same format, though. Unpretentious, price reasonable, really going after the Pittsburgh demographics, nothing too wordy, everything that people could understand, nothing where it's intimidating at all, but just a little more attention to detail. Then, you know, from there, you know, nominated 2 years in a row, James Beard. And then, you know, our bar program just took off, and, you know, pretty proud of it. You know, we make all our, you know, do ice programs and juice programs, and we really, you know, try to set the bar here in Pittsburgh. And the thing about, you know, Butch and Arai that people don't understand, a lot of the places that do get recognition for the bar programs are 99% bar programs. But we're actually bar and food at the same time. So we do the same attention to detail as the bar and the food. So have the same, that caliber of food with the same caliber of alcohol at the same time is pretty special. Because a lot of the places that do a great bar program are so focused just in the bar program. You know, PDT, things of that nature. The bar programs are amazing, but you're also eating hot dogs from next door. We're really, really trying to hit all, you know, really take off. And, you know, the food is just as important as the bar. The bar is just as important as the food. The decor is as important as everything else. So it's just, it's about the whole experience. And then from there, you know, okay, what's next on my plate? You know, there was that place next door that was, went, out of business. It was a check cashing place. And, for me, I'm always thinking, what's Pittsburgh need? What will do well here? What do we need in Pittsburgh, thriving city that we're becoming? And I'm like, man, we need a late night taco place. We need some late night food. You know, every city I go to, there's always one stop where I'm eating some type of tacos. And I knew I wanted to do something like that. We really focused on, I mean, the place was small. We really went after that street atmosphere, you know, tequila bar. And me, and of course, Chef Dave Razakoff, we really focused on making homemade tortillas. So, you know, we're not reinventing the wheel in any way, but we're really trying to do the best taco that we can. We're, you know, we're not buying tortilla shells from down the street, or we're not just adding funky ingredients in to make them fancy tacos. You know, we really, you know, try to focus on Mexican cuisine and learning the techniques and how to roast the chilies and doing the pastores and the carnitas and things like that. And then we have the chefier tacos, the octopus taco and the Korean beef taco and things like that. So it's a balance. And then we have, of course, the fun atmosphere in the back that's so drink-driven with all the different tequilas and the margaritas and things like that. And it's that alone, I mean, it's just been, it took off as well. So, and now this is my fourth restaurant in a one-block radius is pork and beans. And with Pork and Beans is, you know, same thing. You know, what do we need? What do we need downtown? What do we need in Pittsburgh? So for my fourth restaurant, I was just like, you know, what I always think about where I'm putting a restaurant, what would do well in an area, and how the space looks. So it's not just like right off the bat. I look at the space and what can this space become and what does the space look like and, you know, what does this particular area need? You know, we're right next to the ballparks, you know, PNC's right across the bridge, 200 yards from us. We get such a big traffic that comes through here, the Clemente Bridge. So once again, I'm trying to understand what will go here. It's not like just I'm the chef artist, and I'm just going to do what I want. I'm not doing a fine dining restaurant where hundreds of thousands of people are going to the ballpark every day. I'm not going to do a fine. You know, I want to do something like a very beer-driven establishment. When that's why we start, you know, barbecue. I've been smoking for a long time. I fell in love with smoking. It's a different animal and complete, you know, we're cooking things 14 hours at a time, you know, so you're really trying to pay attention. It's all about the product and the technique. It's not fancy. It's not thrills. It's just, you know, it's the techniques and trying to, you know, make the meat the star. And we've been open for about 5 weeks now. So far, it's been going amazing. There's some tweaks and that along the way, but, you know, because I'm a, you know, particular about every little detail, and I'm not happy until things are great. But I'm so far, this has probably been my smoothest opening to date, and you know, pretty excited about it.
I don't know where to go next, because I always find out talking to you. I wanted to say that you haven't adequately described how you totally conceptualize a restaurant. And I've seen you hammering used boards into a ceiling yourself. It's not just the food, it's the bar program, it's the location, it's the decor, it's little tiny things like your mason jar lights. You are admittedly a perfectionist, right?
Well, I mean, it's a fine line between failure and success. And for me, it's all the little details that make something from good to great. And it's all the little details from what, you know, what the menu looks like, to what the bottle, you know, what a business card looks like, to what I want my staff to wear. And I think that's what really sets us apart, because we try, you know, there's no, you know, stone unturned. You know, it's like, okay, how do we want the barbecue sauces to look? How do we want, you know, what type of boxes do we want them in? How do we want the silverware? And it's always like, when you're at this place, it feels like you probably should be eating barbecue. So if you sat here and you look like, what should I eat here? Your already mentality is like, wow, this looks like I'm in the South. I'm in a shed. It's got this grimy barbecue feel, you know, and it's all about the whole experience that ties together. And same with the cocktails itself. You know, you're drinking out of tin cans. And for me, it's all about having fun. Unwind, relax, you're not working, enjoy yourself, enjoy your company, interact, share some smoked meats, have some drinks, and have a good time. So, you know.
You're also trying to do some other things. We've talked about these things, but you don't like actually pinning yourself down to talking about your idea about it goes way beyond being a chef or having a successful money-making business. You cooperate and draw in other talents, other chefs to partner with you and to work with you. You've done that even since 909. Tell us a little bit about this philosophy of being a restaurateur, what you think your responsibilities are, and how you want to make everything a good place for just about everybody you contact with.
I think one of the things that I, you know, my business motto is always is, you know, this isn't the Richard DeShantz show. Sometimes you hear about chef's name. It's always about the main chef. But so many more important people that are key factors in the success of this business. We have 300-plus employees here. So for me to take all the credit is absolutely impossible. And I'm smart enough to know you're only as strong as the people make you around you. You're only as successful as the people make you. And so I really hold strong to that, and I try to, you know, we have this family mentality, and I try to bring in strong people, a good support group. And I think they, you know, the passion that I have and the passion that they have, and it just works well together. I'm I'm a very humble person. It's not about Richard DeShantz. Right now, I mean, it's about the Richard DeShantz restaurant group that supports 300-some-plus employees, that supports their families, that changing a neighborhood. I mean, I'm more, my success is when I see happy people coming into the restaurant, and we're changing the whole demographics of a downtown area, you know, one building at a time. And that's where I'm taking, you know, that's what makes me proud. And, like, it makes me proud knowing that there's so many families that actually depend on us because, you know, we pay all the health benefits for 300-some employees. We have profit shares for different employees. I have percentages, you know, for my main people that are coming up. So, you know, I'm going to take care of everyone that takes care of me. I give opportunities. I don't give everything away for free, but you have the opportunity to make a very successful life, you know, working with us. I give the opportunities, and when they roll with it, they roll with it, and they reap the benefits, of course. You know, you have to take care of the people that take care of you. So.
Well, you've revitalized downtown, and you have one more restaurant you're developing already downtown. Tell us about that. And also, you have bought a building that's a well-known restaurant site, and you're going to put two more concepts in there. What can you tell us about these?
So our next step is, once again, same block radius. We're actually working on a like a raw concept, focusing on Asian flavors, Asian profiles, really working on different from sashimis to tartars to crudos to... It's a small space. It's an empty space. For me, when I see an empty space downtown, it makes me sad. And I'd rather do something in this space to bring something to the community, bring something to the, you know, the downtown. I always, like, once again, I'm like, what do we need? What do we need? And, you know, the space is so small. I knew I didn't want to put, like, a full-fledged, gigantic kitchen in there. As a businessman, I know it couldn't support, you know, I couldn't put, like, putting $500,000 into this space. It would not be able to generate that much money out. It's only a 25-seat restaurant. And over the years, I love working with raw ingredients, you know, from raw vegetables to raw fish to raw meats and things like that. And it's I'm pretty excited about this this new project because it's so small, it's going to really let us shine. It's going to let us really focus on each dish in particular because we're only doing so many covers, and so we can really have attention to detail, really push the envelope using raw different things from, like I said, fish to veggies, and then the bar program. We're putting another bar program in there. All, I think, another reason why our restaurants are successful is they've all have this balance between alcohol and food. I mean, we're about 40-60, which is a lot in the restaurant business. So, I mean, it's nice to have such a great, you know, drink programs with all the restaurants, what we do. And it's going to be one gigantic bar. There's going to be two bartenders and two chefs behind there. You're probably not going to know which ones are the bartenders or chefs because they're all going to be dressed the same. And we're going to have about 12 to 14 specialty cocktails and some funky sakis and weird beers from around the world and some just interesting raw dishes that we're creating. You know, there's three chefs working on things. Like you said, I surround myself from a great team. So with Dave Razakoff and Dan Carlton, you know, I'm pretty confident that we're going to pull this off. So, and then our next venture after that is we took over the old Salt of the Earth space, a staple of Pittsburgh, a great James Beard nomination place. You know, it's a beautiful place. It's a great neighborhood. It's coming up in... it's going to be interesting to see what we do with it. I'm excited because it is my first building that I bought. I bought the building and the lot next to it. So I think as a businessman and entrepreneur, I think it was the next step to start owning property. Unfortunately, downtown, I'm not buying $20 million garages. But in Garfield, I could afford a story building. And it's going to let me push the envelope again because I own the building. So I'm really going to be able to, you know, put more into the building because I own the building. And I think the key with that is really trying to change the formula. I'm going to try to enhance the space and sometimes try to celebrate at the same time. I don't want to just gut it and change because I think it has beautiful bones and structure and it is pretty and what they've done there was a great thing. So I want to try to embrace it, change it to get out from, you know, this umbrella assault But when you're still there, you see the elements that are there. So it's, I'm just trying to enhance it. And, you know, the concept is we'll be working on it in the next few months, you know. And I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag on that one because it's, you know, it's a developing process. But we're probably mid-summer, early spring next year for that one.
So. Now, you recently won in Pittsburgh. So it was local or regional Entrepreneur of the Year. And you talked to me about going to the national event, which was a competition, and you lost out the first place to a very large establishment. But you were really excited about the whole experience. What did you think about it?
Well, I mean, being recognized as a chef is one thing. I mean, being recognized in anything is just recognizing that you're really trying, you know, because we work so hard every day. We're working 16-hour days as a chef, as an owner. You know, it's a lot of sacrifice to get where we're going. And anytime, any type of little, you know, nod or whatnot is at your way, it's like, wow, I am doing something great. For this particular thing, because it is outside the restaurant in general, was just completely took me off by, you know, I was shocked. So when we were nominated, you know, in a Pittsburgh, we're nominated in this region, I'm like, oh, well, that's great. And I didn't really think a lot of it because I did a little research, but I'm like, okay, we're restaurant tier. We do great. I thought a little nomination. And then when we went to the event in Pittsburgh, I was like, wow, this is pretty spectacular. Just to be recognized in this fashion, to be recognized with like CEOs and doctors and just be to recognize not just for the restaurant field, but just in general of building a city, doing something great for the community. And I didn't really have a speech, unfortunately, because I was like, there's no way in hell I'm going to win this thing. But when we won, I was blown away. And it's funny because in my speech, I was like, I was just like, wow, entrepreneur. I said, I don't even know if I could spell that. But you know, I said, you know, I'm so blessed just to be recognized for doing something you love. And when you're doing something you love, it's really not work. For me, it's a passion, and I do it because I love it, and I love doing something for the community. But then recently we went to the Nationals in Palm Springs, and 5,000 people were there. Will Smith was a guest host. Seth Meyers was speaking. The CEO of JW Marriott was actually the overall winner. So very humbling, like, I was pretty much speechless. I was actually so nervous there. I was sweating. I think I drank 10 kettles. But to be, like I said, once again, just to be recognized in anything is just amazing. But to be recognized outside of your craft, to be recognized in a, you know, community of all these CEOs and doctors and everyone that's really trying hard to do something for the community, for the world, is just...
Well, you're super.
Rick is a man of very few words. And I think we just got a lifetime supply. but if you can hear in the background, you can hear what this is all about. I'm just going to turn the microphone away from my mouth so you can hear what happens in a Rick Deschamps restaurant. Don't you wish you were here?
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
While we had a hook into the Richard Deschamps Wrestling Group, we were moved to correspond with one of our favorite bartenders, just as the restaurant industry in Pittsburgh has been catching up and has been on the moving towards the national stage for a long time. The bar program, the cocktail programs in
Pittsburgh are rather amazing, of the local chapter of the Bartenders Guild in Pittsburgh. It is probably one of the largest in the whole country. And as I said, we're going to talk to our favorite bartender here, Cecil Usher, who is the head of the bar program and I don't know what you'd call him. I call him bartender. Anyhow, at Butcher in the Rye, which is the Deschamps, or Richard Deschamps restaurant. Let's listen to Cecil, who really has a handle on what's moving and shaking in the cocktail world.
Hold on a second. Let's back-to-back him with someone responsible for the food, because this is a food enterprise after all as well.
Okay, well,
right after Cecil, we'll switch over to the food at
Pork and Beans,
the most recent opening, and
latest of the Deschamps Restaurant Group.
And the chef, Keith Fuller, who's been a friend of ours for years.
Yes. We're going to be talking to Cecil Usher. Cecil, you have the enviable job of being bar manager and beverage director for Butcher in the Rye, like my favorite bar restaurant. It's a restaurant, isn't it? And the bar is on the second floor, but you do the whole bar program, the beverage program.
We have two bars.
Yeah, in Pittsburgh. And last time I talked to somebody, and I can't remember who it was, about the bar program at Butcher, the idea was to get, I think you had like 500, 600 labels of bourbon. You've come on board in the last year or so, a year and a half, and you took over and tried to refocus it. Tell us a little bit about that and what it involves.
I think when we first opened up, it was just trying to obtain as many as possible to kind of fill up the wall. We did a really good job with that. At one point, amassing probably close to 700 plus different items. But there were a lot of things that were just kind of fillers. So when I took over, what I wanted to do was to make sure that we had all the things that whiskey connoisseurs and collectors would come to, you know, appreciate. And work directly with the distilleries. When I go down to Kentucky once a year and try to, you know, continue relationships with them where we can have a lot of the things that are usually hard to get.
An example,
actually just recently, today I was able to procure my hands on some High West Campfire, which is typically a spirit that was available pretty widely throughout Pennsylvania, and then all of a sudden kind of dried up just through it being acquired by different companies. And so for the past 2 months, I had to kind of play a game of cat and mouse, tracking down, working with reps, working with the brand to be able to procure some bottles. So as of now, we probably will have the largest amount until on their end until they figure out what they're going to do with the product. So, like, I try to make sure that we always continue to have the lines that people come to know. Uh-huh. People want to come for Pappy Van Winkle. We try to make sure that we have Pappy Van Winkle in house.
How's that going? We asked Rick the other day, and
asked Tolga.
Did we ask Tolga?
Yeah.
So what's the scoop? What's the scoop? Do you have any, or you don't?
We do.
Good.
We have the whole entire collection except for Pappy 15, which is one of the hardest to get. We did have that, and it sold well. No matter what we priced it at, people will pay for it because it is one of the harder ones to get. Oddly enough, not even the older ones, 20 or 23.
Really? Huh.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, what makes it? How many brands, bottles, or labels do you carry now?
Right now, last counted, there's about 714 on the wall.
Okay.
We've expanded our scotch selection, which I'm really proud of. I think over the period of time, we're probably about maybe 119, 120 different expressions. A lot of good collector items.
Like what? Give me an example.
We got the beyond just a couple of distilleries last year went into their 200th anniversary, Laphroaig and Ardbeg.
Laphroaig is my scotch.
Oh, yeah. We have the whole entire collection of Laphroaig. We have over 13 different expressions that they offer.
Wow, I didn't know there were that many. I'm coming.
Yeah, and that's kind of, and that's exactly what we're trying to do here, is where we're trying to, people know the basics, and I want to create an experience when you come here and you say, I like this. Either I can suggest something completely new and a new range, or if you like, you said, Laphroaig, I can say, have you tried the Lore? Have you tried the Quarter Cask? Have you tried the Three Wood? Have you tried the Cartagis 2015? Have you tried the Cartagis 2016? You know, we can give you a couple of different options and kind of help you, you know, enhance your experience, even if you're looking for one particular one or trying something new.
Now, the other one you mentioned, our nephew Neil came to visit during the late summer. Mm-hmm. And curious enough, in his bag was a bottle of Ardbeg, which Mrs. Haig has now depleted.
Wait a minute. I didn't deplete it. I went to drink it, and it was gone. You depleted it.
I did not. I only had maybe one little tot out of it.
Because
it was yours. Neil bought it for you.
Anyhow, we're not going to have this argument, Cecil.
What's looking nice with Ardbeg is that we just recently got the two experimental ones, were Galileo and Supernova. They produced a whiskey that they divided. Half of it they aged down on Earth, and the other half they sent up in space.
Wow.
Oh, there you go.
And it was on a space station rotating around Earth.
Jeez.
And then they came back down. They labeled the one that was on Earth Galileo, looking up at the sky, and then Supernova, because it traveled around Earth. And so you can actually kind of taste, it's the exact same, you know, liquid inside, but you can taste the difference between something aged on Earth and something aged in space, which is pretty unique.
And you can do that?
And here, what's the secret? So
we have both of them.
I bet they don't taste the slightest bit different.
It does. Oh, yeah, wow. There's this, and they're not the only one to do it. A couple other distilleries have set stuff up. But what has been coming back from my research and from tasting has been, it's getting this kind of almost like rubber kind of smell, like a tennis, like when you open up a fresh can of tennis balls.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sure.
And you know that smell inside of there, it kind of has that in smell, and almost kind of like a little, like what you would think the taste would be from that. Oddly enough.
It seems like it might not be something that would appeal to me a whole lot, to tell you the truth. I really don't like the sound of it very much.
It's one of those things where, like, you know, when people try wine and it tastes something that's kind of, like, weird or off-putting, you say it might taste like iodine or, you know, or like a Meritage from South Africa kind of has this iron kind of quality to it.
Tell me...
Sounds unpleasant, but...
You had a whole roster of talented bartenders, mixologists doing your cocktails. Do you still have that array of talent?
Something that I've always been personally big on is growing talent and youth. And I brought on a lot of young emerging stars in the city to kind of help bring them up. I wanted to create an atmosphere of learning and education and get people who are hungry to, you know, get this opportunity to work with all that we have here. We are pretty lucky to have, beyond this wealth of wall, we have different products from everywhere. We can do a lot of different cool techniques that a lot of the bars can't necessarily have access to, from sous vides to vacuum machines.
Now you have all of that in the bar, and you do a lot of chef techniques for you, making your own ingredients.
Yeah.
Tell us
some
of that made from scratch stuff.
Yeah, we've recently been working on making our own creme de cacao, which is a chocolate liqueur, horchata, which is a rice kind of cream. That's that kind of like winter spiced. I've sous vide figs into Russell's Reserve rye whiskey.
Wow.
So, to kind of for adding for a cocktail, and added pecans and bananas to a rum. Through infusing things. We're working on now on doing a lot of clarifications where we're taking a usually cloudy liquid and completely making it clear or see-through.
Wow. And what about your ice program? Do you still have that going?
Yeah, we still have the ice program. The ice chef that we had here now, he's still with us, but he's on tour now. He joined a rock band, and he's on touring Europe and Asia. But he trained his replacement, who's here now and is continuing on the process. We all kind of chip in, and you know, there's, I think now more than anything else, we all specialize in everything in the bar. I want everybody's hands on all the products, and everybody is talented and knows how to process all the information.
Well, I'm assuming that you probably travel around and visit a lot of out-of-town bars nationally, West Coast, East Coast. Is that true?
Yes. I'm very in the bartender community. I travel and volunteer at a lot of national events. I participate in Camp Run Amok every year for the past 2-3 years, which is a bartender camp in the middle of Kentucky where they take 150 bartenders and they visit different distilleries, and you get behind-the-scenes tours by the master distillers themselves. And you taste with them, and you learn about the products in and out, which is a very, you know, amazing thing, and especially for what I'm doing, to get that kind of access, you know, to these people and these luminaries in our industry. I go to, I was in New York for the Bar Institute, which is put on by Lush Life, which is an amazing organization that puts on a lot of national events for the bartender community throughout the year.
Now tell me this, what is, if you can, that's a tricky question, I guess, what is your favorite bar? What do you think is like the best bar in America?
My favorite bar, I would have to say, probably my personal favorite bar right now would be Holiday Cocktail Lounge in New York City. The reason why I would say that is because it is like a neighborhood bar that you would see in any city. It's not fancy in any kind of way. There's no Edison lights. There's no, you know, pre-prohibition wear or attire. There's a jukebox playing, you know, 80s music. It's you place where you feel comfortable getting a shot and a beer. However, they do have an excellent cocktail program there, where if you're in the need for a proper made old fashioned, aviation, a last word, a 20th century, they are more than capable of executing any, you know, classic cocktail whim that you may have. So it kind of takes away a lot of that pretension and stuffiness.
Yeah, no, but how about bringing it back, and this is where it gets tricky, in your unbiased opinion, how does your bar, the Butcher and the Rye Bar, stand up to that bar or any other nationally prominent high-profile bar?
Over the past year, actually, recently traveling, I feel that we are right there. I feel the Pittsburgh cocktail scene is not only just emerged, but I think we are on the same par and level. Recently, Butcher and the Rye this past year competed against 5 of the top bars in the whole entire Northeast. Part of this Bar Institute was a traveling bar kind of competition where they picked 5 bars from that regional area to represent against each other, and all we had to do was pretty much talk about our bar and talk about why our bar is special. We competed against bars like Jack Rose in D.C., which they have currently the largest whiskey list, Dead Rabbit in New York City, which is, you know, arguably every for the past 2 years have gotten voted best bar in the country.
Yeah.
We actually, you know, competed, and we tied with Dead Rabbit for 2nd. We beat out Jack Rose. We tied for Dead Rabbit, and they won on the basis of their drinks. Presentation-wise, we were right there. I mean, people, I think, were just as impressed about what we were doing as they were any other bar, because we do have a lot going on here, and people were really surprised. It was nice to see reactions from people after our presentation. They were like, I never knew that was going on in Pittsburgh. Like you guys are doing all that? And, you know, like, from top down, every Monday, I have 8 employees here for 7 hours operating and setting things up, and we're cutting ice, and we're shaping this, and we're infusing, and, like, it's all these techniques that are going on. It's a busy operation to operate. You know, we just don't open and turn on the lights.
Well, I love it. I mean, I view it as a destination bar, although you do have good food, too.
Yeah, and it is, and that's, I think that's a good part about it. I think it plays off each other, where the atmosphere feels that you just want to kind of relax and be there. So you can have some drinks. You can order some small food. We have that small plate section, which is actually the largest section of the menu, because you can sit there and have a couple bites to eat just to kind of, you know, coat your stomach with all the whiskeys you're tasting, or, you know, coming there for a cocktail that you just can't get out of your mind, or somebody else told you about or you read about. We try to build an atmosphere of relaxing. I want people to come here, and not only are we a destination, but we are and want to be a neighborhood bar. I feel great having people come back every day, or, you know, 2 or 3 times a week, because they just love to hang out here. It would be that kind of place because of, you know, from our price point of drinks or whatever, but I think we create, and what I've tried to teach and continue to create, is an atmosphere of relax, of, you know, you come here, you can sit, you feel comfortable, our bartenders are knowledgeable, we want to curate your experience, we're not trying to sell you anything. We listen, and we want to make sure that you are getting exactly what you want.
So what's next, Cecil? What's in your dream field here?
Shoot it to the foreground to show the country what is the amazing things that are happening in the city. I'm not originally from Pittsburgh, but I fell in love with the city, and I represent it every time I travel, and I want to share what I've discovered with everybody else and what I've been here trying to help cultivate. So I have big plans and big dreams to go.
Yeah, I wish you continued success. I feel like running down there right now because it's so much fun. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
No, my pleasure. Yeah, please, anytime. Like I said, this is about the welcoming atmosphere. That's what I believe in more than anything else, is the customer service aspect and making people feel like you're a guest, you know, even better than a customer. Come to my place, sit at my bar, you're my guest. I welcome you in.
Thank you so much, Cecil.
Pleasure.
Keith Fuller is a chef I've known for quite a long time in various situations. Keith, I mean, I can't even remember all of them. But what we're going to talk to you about tonight is you are a partner in this enterprise of pork and beans. Much long-awaited, I must say. It took a while to get this under. And I want you to explain the concept. Rick explained a little bit of it. I'd like your version of it, the concept. And also your programs here with the food, such as your smoking program, smoking the meats, and also some of the special dishes you can pick out. So tell us a little bit about what is pork and beans.
Well, pork and beans is a, you know, low-down smokehouse, like all-American smokehouse, but with a lot of chef twists to it. We're doing a very heavy prep. We're doing, like, brining our pork bellies for 5 days in a pastrami brine. We're doing, you know, people are in the building at all times. We have someone coming in at 3:30 to start pulling out the meats to rest. Then it goes in the smoker. Then the sous chef comes in around 6 or 7, and then another person comes in at, you know, 8 or 9, and then, you know, throughout the day we're tending, spritzing, smoking, curing, making our own sausages. Yeah, the concept too is just to, you know, like, we're doing this kind of like roadhouse, chef-driven roadhouse is a lot of fun, and, you know, doing really interesting cuts of meat and interesting styles of food, but still keeping it kind of, you know, Texas-style barbecue.
Now, this wasn't your background, was it?
No, my background is more fine dining, but, I mean, this is something that we've always thought is fun. We've always talked about doing something. For me, it's a new challenge. I'm working with great people like James. I can't pronounce his last name. James Simonello. And, you know, I'm working with him, and, you know, we're coming up with these concepts and coming up with these specials and, you know, doing, like, really good food. And both of our styles mingle really well. And, you know, with Rick and myself and everybody, it's a great collaboration.
Well, I mean, it's certainly a popular style now. I mean, like, that place in Austin, people line up for 5 hours to get their food. Can you pick out some of your specialties from this menu? I mean, we had a sampler tray that, I mean, most people, they just put it together themselves off the menu. But there was a great deal of variety. Could you just pick out some of your favorites?
Sure. I mean, obviously the brisket is a popular choice. It's smoked all day. It's spritzed with soy and Worcestershire. It's pulled out at the right time. But our beef ribs, which are really funky, they're like whole ribs of beef. They're smoked until they hit that magic number, which I'm not going to say. And then they're pulled out and rested. Our beer can chicken is actually peri-peri, which we make our own peri-peri sauce in the house. We sous vide it in Pabst Blue Ribbon before, then char it on the grill. Our turkey is, like, injected with butter. I think it tastes like smoked lobster. This is what I get out of it. It's just one of my favorites. You know, it's like even from our hot dogs to, you know, our kielbasa to, you know, we have a guy named Chris that makes a lot of sausages in the morning. He's our butcher. And, like, he did this awesome Boudin Noir spread today. So, and then tomorrow I have Tasso Ham going on. So we're going to be doing a lot of cool things, you know, on the, you know, like on the regular menu. Like, we sell a ton of dirty fries, which are JoJo fries, cheese sauce, and brisket, and our pickled jalapenos we make in-house. You know, our ham plate, which is, you know, thinly shaped ham, you know, croquettes, you know, pig's ears. I think our pig's ears are the best. Or we make our own barbecue spice and we toss it, and they're crispy, but they still have a little bit of collagen gumminess to it.
Now, how does this relate to the bar program? Because I thought it was really fun having fancy wine out of a can.
So, yeah, the bar program is really unique and cool. They do a lot of fun Southern Derby-style cocktails, but then they kind of, you know, make it lowbrowish but still look really cool and classic. And, you know, like one of the cocktails that me and Michael, the bar manager, came up with was the green chartreuse Mountain Dew slushy, which we call Squeal Mountain, and it's become a staple. Like, people love it. But I challenged him to make a Mountain Dew chartreuse, you know, cocktail, and that's what we came up with, the slushy, and people love it.
Well, I mean, everybody loves being here because it's so laid back. Is that what you think?
Yeah, I think people love this place. One, it's laid back. Two, it's, you know, it's Pittsburgh's a very blue collar city. You know, a lot of, you know, people want to go out, and, you know, the food's, you know, pretty quick to the table. It's, you know, very time sensitive, but it's like very delicious meats and stuff like that. And, you know, they can order a whole bunch of different things and get to try a lot for not a lot of money. And, you know, I just think it's a cool space, you know, very communal.
Well, you're happy. Are you also going to be a first time dad?
Yeah. Got a couple more months until, my wife has her baby and, I become a father. So.
As I said, we go back a long time, and I'm really pleased to see you doing something different, but you're also having a good time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
I just wanted to put, did you choose to know the sex of your child?
I did not. It's going to be a surprise.
Well, we think Anne's a great girl's name, and Peter's a great boy's name. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, Keith.
Same to you. Thank you so much.
I guess we're into surprises these days, aren't we? So next week's program is going to kick off with a really surprising destination that's in our future, and a lady who's responsible for a lot of what's going on. Shall we say a little bit of a clue on the other side of the world? And that's all you get until same time, same place next week, when the surprise will be revealed. Right, sweetheart? And if not, and until then, what do we say?
Go Steelers!
Hey, there we go.
Bye-bye.